welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, March 19th, 2023. I'm your reader, Sharon Feldudo, and the front page story today, one of the front page stories of the Cedar Rapids Gazette, is from the Iowa Ideas series, Drinking Water, Where Does Yours Come From? By Brittany Miller and Aaron Jordan of the Gazette. Drinking water is harvested from the earth, the sky, the seas. We worry about having enough of it and how to keep it clean, spending millions on infrastructure. But how do Iowans get their drinking water? It can spurt from several sources across the state: deep wells that dip into aquifers, shallow wells stationed near waterways, and surface water from rivers, lakes, and reservoirs. Residents can get their hands on some through one of the state's 1,800-plus public water supply systems. Or they may be one of the approximately 250,000 Iowans who depend on private wells. The groundwater that feeds private wells can be contaminated by farm runoff that often is unmeasured and unregulated. Deeper private wells have their own challenges with minerals, including arsenic and lead. And although municipal water supplies are tightly regulated, suppliers must use expensive technology to combat contaminants, some of which have been emerging more in recent years. To kick off the Iowa Ideas in-depth week about drinking water, the Gazette researched where Iowans' water comes from, how it is or isn't treated, and potential threats to the vital resource. We reviewed the complex journey a droplet takes from source to faucet and obstacles it may face along the way. Regardless of where you go to grab a gallon of water, a puddle somewhere, go to the river, go to a well, that gallon of water is going to be made up of whatever's there, says Cedar Rapids Utilities Director Roy Hesseman. First and foremost, you have to figure out what you've got, what you're dealing with, and then figure out how you want to treat it. Water treatment is complex and costly. When it comes to public water supplies, treatment processes differ depending on factors such as the water source, the location of facilities, and the resources available to purchase and maintain infrastructure. Cedar Rapids, for instance, gets its drinking water from 52 shallow wells stationed along the Cedar River that suck up groundwater percolating through the riverbed. About 36 million gallons of water is drawn each day on average. From there, it's pumped to the city's two drinking water treatment plants, where physical and chemical mechanisms transform it into drinkable water. Some steps remove elements from the liquid. For instance, when it first enters the plants, it is aerated to release any gases in the droplets. It's also softened using lime to remove calcium, magnesium, and other contributors to water hardness. Ultraviolet reactors zap and disfigure viruses into incompetence. Other steps add substances to the water. Sometimes extra ammonia is put in toward the beginning of the treatment process. It will combine with added chlorine at a later step to create a disinfectant for the water. Fluoride is added. Fluoride is added to promote dental health, and zinc orthophosphate is added to minimize pipe corrosion. What leaves the plant and is sent to around 130,000 people is safe drinking water, heavily regulated by federal standards, as with all public water supplies. Any problem with the water requires a public notification to customers. We touch everybody's life in the city every day, and I personally want to make sure that we are providing the highest quality level of public health that we possibly can, Hesseman said. Des Moines Water Works, another large water supplier in the state, draws water both directly from the surface and from shallow wells around the Des Moines and Raccoon Rivers. For the most part, its treatment process is similar to Cedar Rapids, complete with lime softening, filtration, and additions of fluoride and chlorine. But since Des Moines Water Works draws from surface water at two of its three plants, it has extra steps for additional threats. Activated carbon is added to absorb and filter out organic materials such as pesticides and insecticides. Sediment is settled out of the water, and most notably, the supplier has a nitrate removal facility. Although among the largest public water suppliers in the state, Cedar Rapids and Des Moines are in the minority by drawing their source water directly from or around rivers. Nearly 92% of state suppliers, serving 54% of the population, pump groundwater instead, generally to less populated areas. Marion, for instance, has a decentralized, simpler process where groundwater from deep aquifers is disinfected with chlorine gas at four main well sites before getting pumped to customers. Flow from certain wells run through a new iron removal plant that cost $2.8 million. Infrastructure with that price tag may be cost prohibitive for communities with fewer resources and personnel. Mount Vernon's five wells dip into the Jordan and Silurian Devonian aquifers to provide water for the city's population of around 4,500. Chlorine and phosphate are added as disinfectant and corrosion protection. With the city's budget, any future infrastructure updates would be an uphill battle. "I think it all comes down to money," said City Water and Wastewater Superintendent Alex Volkov. "It's never easy to find money for something that generally people don't see, things that are buried underground. As long as it does okay, generally people don't feel like spending millions of dollars on it." When you picture a well, do you envision an opening wide enough to drop down a bucket complete with a handle to haul your water into reach? Think again. Unlike the old-fashioned stereotype, 90% of drinking water wells are only 4 to 6 inches wide, said Chad Greiner of Greiner Well and Pump in Kyoto. For 5 generations, the company has been hooking up pumps in residential wells. By definition, private wells are ones that serve no more than 25 people at least 60 days a year. They are not regulated under the Safe Drinking Water Act, so owners are responsible for their upkeep and monitoring. Most wells are lined with PVC and include periodic openings covered with screens that allow in groundwater. The water is then pumped into pipes that delivers it into sinks and showers in homes. Residential wells can be as shallow as 100 feet or more than 1,000 feet deep, depending on the geology of the earth and the depth of the source aquifer. "In the Cedar Rapids area, the wells are definitely going deeper than they used to," Greiner said. "You keep building houses next to each other and everyone running lawn sprinklers, you're going to deplete the aquifer. You have to go down deeper and deeper to get the same amount of water." An estimated 7.6% of Iowans get their drinking water from private wells, which is about half the estimated 14% to 15% across the country, according to Kelsey Piper, assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at Northeastern University in Boston. The Grants to Counties program, often underutilized, provides money to counties to help residents pay for well testing, which is recommended at least once a year. Counties can use the money to plug abandoned wells, rehabilitate damaged wells, and monitor well water. Testing for any substance with a federal standard, such as PFAS or algal bloom toxins, can be reimbursed. Some funds can help subsidize costs for other well-related needs. Also from the front page, "Will Iowans with Trans Kids Seek Refuge in Minnesota?" by Grace Deng of the Minnesota Reformer. Louis Bullock was 17 years old when Texas Governor Greg Abbott ordered the state to investigate families with children receiving gender-affirming care for child abuse. Bullock, who is non-binary, said that's when they knew their home in a small town outside of Austin was no longer safe. "There had been moments where I would just cry," Bullock said. "I'd be so scared about what was going on. My safety was on the line. My family's safety was on the line. It was a surreal experience. It really felt like we weren't being looked at as people who have feelings." Last year, Bullock, their mother, and their 3 siblings moved to Rochester, Minnesota. Bullock, now 19, said the situation in Texas stirred up anti-trans sentiment, so they got out when they could. Bullock's mother, Catherine Matajez, said she was hearing from trans friends who were being verbally and physically assaulted. One friend, she said, was hit by a car. Nationally, right-wing attacks on transgender people have skyrocketed. At a recent conservative political conference, Daily Wire host Michael Knowles said, "Transgenderism must be eradicated from public life entirely." In the United States, transgender people are 4 times more likely to be the victim of a violent crime. Bullock's family moved to Minnesota in part because of its status as a relatively trans-friendly state, but trans people face violence everywhere, including Minnesota. On February 27th, a transgender woman was brutally attacked at a Minneapolis light rail station. Although Texas is the first state to investigate families of trans kids, at least 29 states have proposed bans on gender-affirming care for minors. Iowa's majority Republican legislature passed a bill that bans gender-affirming care for minors March 8th. As of Friday, it had not yet been signed by Republican Governor Kim Reynolds. There is not yet data on the number of families with trans youth who have left their homes to seek refuge in Minnesota, but the medical director of the Gender Health Program at Children's Minnesota, Dr. Angela Cade Gottford, said they have seen more out-of-state patients and families. Governor Tim Walz signed an executive order March 8th barring Minnesota's agencies from cooperating with other states seeking to prosecute people for traveling for gender-affirming care in Minnesota. At the signing, held the same day as Iowa's legislature passed its gender-affirming care ban, he called on the legislature to add additional protections by passing the Trans Refuge Bill. He said he would even travel to other states and use his platform to advertise Minnesota as a welcoming place. It's one thing to not be a bully. It's another to be anti-bullying, Waltz said. Also from the front page, Protest Trump Investigation Peacefully, Pence Tells Iowa Crowd, by Aaron Murphy of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau. In Des Moines, former Vice President Mike Pence in Iowa on Saturday called the apparent pending arrest of his old boss, former President Donald Trump, a politically motivated prosecution. As for Trump's call on social media for his supporters to protest, Pence said Americans upset about the matter should express themselves peacefully, but not repeat the violent protests on the U.S. Capitol in 2021. Look, we respect the right of Americans to let their voice be heard and to express their frustration over what appears to be a politically motivated prosecution of the former president, Pence told reporters Saturday in downtown Des Moines. But we want to send a very clear message that violence will not be tolerated and that anyone that would engage in violence would be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. Pence was in Iowa to participate in a discussion on foreign policy with Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Joni Ernst. Early Saturday, Trump posted on social media that he expects to be arrested on Tuesday. Trump is the subject of an investigation into allegations that in 2016 he paid two women to silence them about sexual encounters they had with him a decade earlier. Trump ended his post by writing in all caps, "Protest, take our nation back." In a subsequent post, he concluded with a similar call, again in all caps, "We must save America. Protest, protest, protest." Pence spoke to reporters for a little more than 5 minutes Saturday, fielding questions about Trump's claim that he will be arrested in his calls for protest. "The idea of indicting a former president of the United States is deeply troubling to me, as it is to tens of millions of Americans, and particularly happening in what appears to be a politically charged environment in New York, where the attorney general and other elected officials literally campaigned on the pledge to prosecute the former president," Pence said. "No one is above the law. I'm confident President Trump can take care of himself. My focus is going to continue to be on the issues that are affecting the American people." Pence warned against violent protests, similar to the attacks in the U.S. Capitol on January of 2021. That day, Trump claimed without merit that as vice president, Pence had the authority to stop the certification and send the process of confirming the election results back to the states. Some of the protesters at the U.S. Capitol that day could be seen and heard on video chanting, "Hang Mike Pence." "The American people have every right to peaceably assemble and let their voice be heard, and I think it's extremely important that people have a right to express themselves," Pence said. "But that being said, there can be no tolerance for the kind of violence that we saw on January 6th or throughout the summer of 2020. During the foreign policy discussion with Ernst, Pence reiterated his support for U.S. aid to the Ukrainian military in its defense against the Russian invasion, and he expressed support for Ernst's characterization of an American-first foreign policy means a priority on U.S. interest, but not in isolation from other nations. Saturday's event also featured former Maryland Governor Larry Hogan, who earlier this month ruled out a run for president this cycle. In the Iowa Today section and the Week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state, under the heading In the News, State Government Reorganization, the executive branch of Iowa state government, including its myriad departments and agencies, is headed for a massive reorganization now that legislation has been approved by Republicans in the Iowa legislature. Governor Kim Reynolds' proposal to streamline state government passed the Iowa House on Wednesday, having previously passed the Senate. Reynolds' proposal, which was informed by a Virginia-based consulting firm, would reduce the number of state agencies that report directly to the governor from 37 to 16. And would give the governor more leeway in setting salaries for top government positions, among myriad other provisions in the nearly 1,600-page bill. Regents to review diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. All diversity, equity, and inclusion programs at Iowa's public universities will undergo a comprehensive review, and no new DEI programs will be allowed to start during the review, the Iowa Board of Regents announced Tuesday. The announcement came as Republican state lawmakers are proposing legislation that would prohibit Iowa's public universities from funding workers for DEI programs. State income tax reductions. Current state income tax reductions would be sped up, and the tax eventually would be phased out entirely under legislation advanced by Senate Republicans. The bill would make those gradual reductions happen faster, reduce the state income tax rate to 2.55% by 2028, and create a mechanism to eventually phase out the state income tax altogether. Trump makes first Iowa trip of 2023. Former President Donald Trump touted trade policies that he argues have been a boon for America's farmers and attacked Democratic President Joe Biden for a nonstop war on American agriculture in a speech Monday at the Adler Theater in Davenport. It was Trump's first trip to Iowa since declaring his candidacy for president late last year. In what was billed as an education policy speech, Trump spoke about trade policies and agriculture. He also spoke about immigration policy, the teaching of divisive concepts in schools, banning transgender girls from competing in girls' sports, and breaking up the U.S. Department of Education. State revenue down slightly from previous year. Iowa's estimated revenue for the current budget year improved slightly from December, but still is expected to be below last year as 2022 tax cuts take effect, according to the state's Revenue Estimating Conference. And in fiscal 2024, which begins July 1st, revenues are expected to be about 1% below 2023. Under the heading, they said, "If they keep behaving like that, I believe Majority Leader Winchell is going to have a place for his foot moving forward," Iowa House Speaker Pat Grassley jokingly intervening after pun-filled debate about podiatry. "Shortly after I win the president, I will have the disastrous war between Russia and Ukraine settled. It will take 24 hours if it's not done before then," former President Donald Trump during a campaign event in Davenport. Under the heading Odds and Ends, birth control access. Birth control pills, contraceptive patches, and vaginal rings would be available to Iowans from a pharmacist without a prescription under legislation approved Wednesday by the Iowa Senate, including by Republican lawmakers who had previously rejected the proposal. Microchips. Collins Aerospace is pursuing a $22 million expansion of its Northeast Cedar Rapids campus to begin the production of microchips. The Cedar Rapids City Council on Tuesday awarded $1.5 million in financial incentives to support the project for Collins, a division of Raytheon Technologies, to renovate an existing building on campus. Under the heading Water Cooler, more train traffic coming to Iowa. The promise of a robust rail network led to federal approval of a train merger that is expected to deliver considerably more train traffic to several cities in eastern Iowa. The Surface Transportation Board, a federal regulatory authority, announced its decision Wednesday, clearing the way for the merger of Canadian Pacific and Kansas City Southern. And women's basketball capital. Three NCAA women's basketball teams from Iowa, the University of Iowa, Iowa State University, and Drake University, won their respective conference tournament championships. The Big Ten champion Hawkeyes, Big 12 champion Cyclones, and Missouri Valley Conference champion Bulldogs all earned spots in the NCAA tournament field. From the Insight page, Althea Cole writes in her To a Candid World column, "False binary fails to convince Iowans on LGBTQ issues. There's a candy shop that my family and I have patronized for years because it sells us stuff that we really, really like. I follow them on Facebook to stay up to date on their business happenings, and I give them an opportunity to keep luring me back with pictures of their latest goodies. A post the business shared last week caught my eye, but not because it was a business update or picture of something that would make me drool. It was a proclamation in reaction to legislation both in Iowa and around the country regarding topics ranging from abortion to elections to LGBTQ issues, which the business described as aimed at suppressing and removing certain people's rights, according to the Facebook post made by the owners. We do not support any of these actions. We believe they are acts of hate and come from a place of fear," stated the caption on the post. "Today we formally proclaim we are anti-hate." The proclamation itself was pretty vanilla, with the usual striving to create a safe space and all people are welcome type language. The caption on the post, which made the assertions of motivations of hate and fear and suppression, was more interesting to me. If you disagree with our beliefs, it's okay," it read. But it isn't okay, apparently. In that very same caption, the business and its owners had intimated why. Hate is not okay, hence the stunning and brave act of proclaiming that they were anti-hate. The legislation they were speaking out against was, according to them, driven by hate. If a person supports any of the legislation to which they were referring, that person is supportive of hate motivated by fear. Did the business mean to imply that anyone who supports the legislation is a supporter of hate? Certainly not. Hence the insistence that it was okay to disagree, lest they alienate any customer who may have found the message less than inspiring. But by hinting that one side of the issue is driven by welcome and the other driven by discrimination, the Facebook post nevertheless demonstrated this false dichotomy posed to anyone trying to make sense of LGBTQ issues. Anything other than a total embrace is seen as a rejection of the LGBTQ community, a rigid binary of allies or antis, with no room in the middle for nuance or moderation, no spectrum of concepts within which one can concur on some dissent on others. Love is love, and be a good human. Right on. Uncomfortable with cross-sex hormones prescribed to minors or children being allowed to alter their identity without knowledge or consent of parents? You evil, discriminating bigot. Culture wars are a hot topic right now, with many of its battles being fought in legislative chambers nationwide. In the Iowa State House, where Republicans control both chambers, legislation already passed as of the end of last week includes a bill to prohibit surgical and or medical treatment of minors to affirm a minor's perception of gender that is inconsistent with their sex. It awaits Kim Reynolds' signature. On March 8th, the Iowa House approved a bill prohibiting the instruction of gender identity and sexual orientation for students in kindergarten through sixth grade. It now goes to the Senate. On Thursday, lawmakers passed a bill requiring that all people at Iowa schools use intimate spaces such as restrooms and locker rooms that correspond with their biological sex. Are those bills based on hatred for LGBTQ kids? Those who oppose them are quick to say so. Was this legislation what voters asked for when they elected Republicans to sweeping majorities and signed on to another 4 years of Kim Reynolds? Recent polling suggests that it is. A Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll revealed that 52% of Iowa adults surveyed, including half of those who are parents of children under 18, favor legislation to ban gender-affirming medical treatments in minors. An even larger majority supports prohibiting instruction on gender identity and sexual orientation to children in sixth grade or younger. Notably, the survey was taken during the days immediately preceding and including the day gender identity instruction bill passed the House. When accounting just for parents of minor children, the number of those polled who support a ban on gender identity education for K-6 students exceeds the number of those who do not by over 20 points. If LGBTQ issues in Iowa really are viewed through the binary of love versus hate, support versus oppression, or acceptance versus rejection, then it only stands to reason that more than half of Iowa adults hate transgender kids. Does a reasonable person really believe that? Plenty, whom I would describe as less than reasonable, do believe that most Iowans favor the targeting of transgender youth. Their invective regularly makes its way to my email inbox or my Twitter account. In May, I wrote an analysis of the Linmar Community School District's gender identity support policy, during which I dove somewhat deep into the potential conflicts while still taking care to posit that the new policy was not born out of some sinister agenda. One reader sent an email calling the article disgusting, hateful, and vile. A response to another article on the subject included terms like ignorant, stupid, poorly informed, unsafe, disgusting bigot, and bad person, and that was from just one reader who apparently got out their thesaurus. Limiting the reasons for a person's stance on these issues to the mutually exclusive motivations of support or hatred is not only a false dichotomy, but a nasty one at times. I never mind the nasty comments. Journalism takes a thick skin, but the observation of rage isn't limited to your friendly, vile, and disgusting neighborhood columnist. It's observed by others who don't want to be its target. To be shamed as a bigot is something no one wants. When those who do speak out with valid concerns are labeled as extremists, those who don't want to be labeled extremists opt not to speak up. When that happens, it's easy to assume that the momentum is on the side of the opposition. But it isn't. The last general election showed us that, and the recent Iowa poll confirmed that Iowans feel legislative intervention is warranted to address and prevent unwise gender identity-focused practices. Agree or disagree, if all the opposition has is to proclaim everyone else bigots, those at whom they hurl their invective will likely keep electing those same evil Republicans, and those evil Republicans will keep fighting the battle of culture war inside the Iowa State House and even win a few. And from editorial fellow Sophia DiMartino, discrimination, not LGBTQ Iowans, is the real problem. This legislative session in Des Moines, over a dozen bills were proposed that would directly affect or were created in response to misinformation regarding LGBTQ Iowans. Many of these did not survive the March 3rd funnel date, including a bill similar to the new Tennessee law banning drag performance in public spaces, and another that would ban all demographics data collection pertaining to gender identity. However, several remain in play. Bills designed to eliminate funding for diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts, forcibly out transgender students, ban books, and bar any mention of gender identity or sexual orientation through the sixth grade. The proposed Iowa legislation has exposed bigotry and willful obtusity among its supporters. Associating drag performance with pedophilia is violence. Applying inflammatory language like grooming and indoctrination of children is harmful to both drag performers and children. How can we accurately identify and address potential threats to the well-being of our children if we have misappropriated terminology for indicators of abuse to discriminate against people reading storybooks in clothes we don't like? Several of the bills are worded in a way that betrays ignorance of the issues they are intended to address. For example, the now-dead Senate File 348 defined drag as a performer who exhibits a gender identity different from that was assigned them at birth, who sings, lip-syncs, dances, reads, or otherwise performs before an audience for entertainment. The bill would bar anyone under 18 from attending any so-defined performance. The bill relies on an inaccurate gender binary and conflates gender with sex, the designation often assigned at birth based on biological attributes. The American Medical Association advocated for removing the sex designation from birth certificates altogether 2 years ago, which could have led to some interesting attempts to enforce the ban had it become law. Biological attributes have proved to be a challenging tool for defining sex, as both chromosomal and anatomical variations exist beyond the binary. When the variations are subtle, they sometimes fly under the radar so completely that people are unaware they are in possession of traits not typically associated with the sex they were assigned at birth. Gender also has an entirely different definition. The World Health Organization defines gender as both socially constructed, rather than biological, and varying among cultures and over time. The portrayal of any divergence from heteronormative and gender stereotypical behaviors as perverse or immoral is a continuation of historical discrimination against the LGBTQ community, and the discrimination is the problem. Discrimination is directly associated with disparities in mental and physical health, substance abuse, and more. The bills, those that survived the funnel and those that did not, are a clear effort to leverage systemic power for the further oppression of people already experiencing negative outcomes associated with discrimination. Some proponents of these measures will actually point to disparities data as a reason to further the anti-LGBTQ agenda, as though they believe they can prevent the disparities by preventing people from becoming LGBTQ. This thinking is flawed and harmful. The proposed legislation would instead intensify trauma experienced by LGBTQ youth, deny them medical care, both gender-affirming and for the common cold, and deny them access to public spaces. Banning discussion of a topic will not cause it to disappear, but it will contribute to the ignorance that leads to ostracization, isolation, bullying, and abuse. In 2007, the Iowa Civil Rights Act was expanded to include gender identity and sexual orientation. In 2009, Iowa legalized same-sex marriage. As I recall, the decision to uphold equality came as a shock. Couples who had been waiting decades finally had the opportunity to make it official and to access the rights and protections afforded by tying the knot. In the fall of 2009, Modern Family debuted on network television, and for the first time, America had the opportunity to observe sitcom representation of a family unit with a child headed by a same-sex couple. 14 years later, it is so disappointing to bear witness to this lockstep alignment of the GOP leveraging misinformation and hatred toward LGBTQ people by state as a play to the base leading into 2024. There is a lack of subject matter comprehension evident in proposed legislation across the country that leaves attempts at a dialogue feeling hollow and one-sided. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to have inspired much research on the part of supporters. If you would like to seek additional information or resources, One Iowa is a phenomenal place to start. For more, please visit hrc.org. Today's editorial cartoon is from Joe Heller, who is based in Green Bay. Family of three sits on the couch with the TV on in front of them. The TV says everything, everywhere, all at once. And Mom, who is sitting on the couch looking at an iPad with a news report, the news says EPA to limit PFAS. Mom remarks, I'm guessing it's about toxic forever chemicals everywhere and in everything. The first community letter today is from Diane Duncan Goldsmith of Iowa City. Republicans never explain promises. Iowa House Speaker Pat Grassley described Republican bills as issues voters expressed concern about, such as private school scholarships and liability limits. He also said, I think that's what our number one priority is. We need to campaign on a set of policies, and whatever those are, if Iowans reward us with majorities, I think we want to follow through with that. But Republicans never explain their promises. In Governor Kim Reynolds' one debate, she failed to describe drastic changes in her school choice plan. Scholarships for 10,000 low-income students became spending about $1 billion on vouchers for all students. Too often, Republicans fail to participate in voter forums or answer questions from newspapers, leaving their constituents in the dark about where they stand on issues. Ryan Wise, dean of the School of Education at Drake University and former director of the Iowa Department of Education, explains education majors are trained not to push a political agenda, but instead create learning communities that foster academic success and civic engagement, two primary educational objectives. GOP-controlled curriculum and reading lists will not prepare Iowa students to be productive, informed citizens in a diverse, globally interconnected world. Low-income families will be required to jump through hoops to qualify for food stamps. Do not forget, parents' rights do not apply to complex decisions regarding appropriate medical care for a trans child. U.S. Department of Labor officials have criticized proposed child labor law changes. Lack of GOP transparency had consequences. Iowans must pay attention. Diane Duncan Goldsmith of Iowa City. The next letter is from David Hellman of Salem. Fight cancer war, not culture war. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis tells Iowa Republicans culture wars can win elections. DeSantis visits as the Iowa Cancer Registry reveals Iowa has the second highest cancer incidence in the nation and is the only state with a rising rate of cancer. Iowa Republicans' time might be better spent fighting the cancer war and not encouraging Iowans to fight each other. But then DeSantis will likely label this another idle notion from the woke left. David Hellman, Salem. The next letter is from Paul Atre of Coralville. Ference and Barta deserve our support. I have been reading the astonishingly unbelievable negative portrayals of our beloved football coach and our illustrious athletic director. As administrator of the Department of Orthopedic Surgery for over 30 years, I interacted frequently with Coach Ference and athletic director Gary Barta. I was impressed with their integrity and professionalism. As the organizer of the Ponseti races to help children suffering from the club foot deformity, I asked Coach Ference to join Dr. Ernie Found to serve as honorary chair of the races. Without hesitation, he promptly accepted. Every year, they both served in this role faithfully and enthusiastically. Often, Coach Ference invited football players to participate in the races. In my interactions with Ference and Barter, they always exhibited integrity, kindness, and compassion. Their values were honorable and decent. In light of the recent criticism of these great leaders, we need to uplift them and support them. Paul Atre of Coralville. And the next letter is from William A. Lester of Manchester. Thanks to Reynolds and other Iowa Republicans. To the Republican legislators of Iowa and Governor Kim Reynolds, thank you for attacking the most vulnerable in Iowa by promoting hateful legislation to protect us from the threat of transgender and LGBTQ youth. Thank you for attacking the most vulnerable in Iowa who are struggling to put food on their table and feed their kids. Thank you for granting more power to the governor so she can select judges who will follow an extremely conservative agenda. Thank you for weakening public education and deciding to benefit private parochial schools that promote only a Christian extreme conservative agenda. Thank you for creating legislation that attacks diversity of thought and literacy by restricting access to literature and education that makes people uncomfortable, having to deal with the way the world really is and exposure to non-biased history. Thank you for not promoting legislation to clean up our lakes and rivers, which are among the dirtiest in the nation. Thank you for not addressing the lack of child care in this state. Thank you for not addressing affordable housing, homelessness, and food insecurity. Thank you for not addressing the shrinking and dying of the small rural towns in Iowa. Finally, thank you for making this state so much less attractive to our youth, which will make their decision to leave Iowa so much easier. William A. Lester of Manchester. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, March 19th, 2023. I'm your reader, Sharon Faldudo, and we turn to today's obituaries. Harry A. Scott, age 83, of Cedar Rapids, died peacefully in his home on March 10th after a short illness. A celebration of life will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, March 25th, at Tien Funeral Home. He received his master's degree from the University of Pittsburgh and then accepted a position as a guidance counselor at Area 10 Community College, now known as Kirkwood. He subsequently earned his Ph.D. from Pitt and returned to Kirkwood, where he continued to work as a counselor. He offered sage advice and much encouragement to many students until his retirement in 1999. Harry's family was important to him, and he spent countless hours in gyms and at ball fields watching his children. Harry was a bit frugal, yet generous to a fault, championed causes and people, willing to go out of his way to offer assistance and encouragement. He cared deeply about people and was loyal to those he loved. He was grateful for all the good that came his way. Harry was a good guy and will be greatly missed. Esther LeClaire, age 81, of Monticello, died Thursday, March 16th at St. Luke's Hospital, Cedar Rapids, following a brief illness. A celebration of life will be held from 1 to 4 p.m. April 8th at the Hopkinton Community Center. Getch Funeral Home has taken Esther and her family into their care. She lived in Cedar Rapids and Hopkinton before making her home in Monticello. Esther was a homemaker and worked for Lux Farms. She loved to go dancing whenever she could. Minor Barnes of Cedar Rapids died Monday, March 13th at 92 years of age. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, March 24th at First Presbyterian Church. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home will be managing arrangements. He enlisted in Navy Officer Candidate School in Newport, Rhode Island, following graduation in 1953, and Ensign Barnes began his naval service with minesweeper duty aboard the USS Ruddy, which he joined at Incheon, Korea. Then he operated in the Pacific with home ports in Sasebo, Japan, and Long Beach, California. After the Navy, Miner worked in Minneapolis for Prudential Insurance, editing a publication for insurance agents. He returned to the UI College of Law. He joined the law firm of Ross, Johnson, Stewart, Tinley & Peters in Council Bluffs, and he retired from Pickens, Barnes, and Abernathy in 1996. He moved to South Carolina for the beach, sun, and golf on Kiowa Island. Dorothy M. Johnson, age 92, of Marion, passed away on Thursday, January 26, 2023, at the Views in Marion. In agreement with her wishes, cremation has taken place. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, March 23rd at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion, where a visitation will be held 1 hour prior. Interment will follow the service at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Barbara Ettinger, born Barbara Robinson, age 96 of St. Louis Park, Minnesota, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away on March 7th after a brief illness. Barbara was born in Sioux City, Iowa, and spent most of her adult life in Cedar Rapids. She was active at Temple Judah Sisterhood and Hadassah. She worked many years for Frank Maggot and Associates. Barbara loved playing tennis and mahjong, throwing dinner parties, and spending time with her family and friends. Private interment followed by a celebration of life at noon, April 30th at Edina Country Club, 5100 Wooddale Avenue in Edina. Kevin Allen Gertson, age 65 of Marion, passed away peacefully, surrounded by family, on Thursday, March 9th at Hospice of Mercy. He taught fifth grade at St. Ludmilla Catholic School, known as Mr. G, until 1997 when he became a stay-at-home dad. When he recapped his day, he would say, "The kids and I were at the park with all the other moms and kids." He was previously a board member of the Marion Public Library, enjoyed driving 3 days a week for Meals on Wheels, was a member of the Lynn Mar Chain Gang, and coached Metro Youth Football for 17 years. Kevin was an avid Lynn Mar Lions, Iowa Hawkeyes, Chicago White Sox, and Chicago Bears fan. He was known for waking up his family with the famous "You can put it on the board, yes," after a White Sox home run. He possessed a kind and giving heart with a mind full of quick-witted banter and answers to trivia questions. A celebration of life will be held from 5 to 8 p.m. June 23rd at Low Park, 4500 North 10th Street in Marion. Kevin's desire for the celebration to be with attendees dressed in their favorite sports teams wear or in casual clothes. Brandon Stockdale, age 28 of Denver, Colorado, formerly of Iowa Falls, passed away at his home in Denver on March 14th. Funeral services will be 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 25th at Bethany Lutheran Church in Iowa Falls, with burial in Union Cemetery. Following the lunch at the church, a celebration of life will follow at Highland Golf Club. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, March 24th at the church. Funeral arrangements are under the guidance of the Searles Funeral Home in Iowa Falls. If you knew Brandon, you knew that he loved to have fun, was outgoing, and enjoyed life and had a huge heart. He enjoyed gaming online with his brothers. He called his grandparents his favorite people and loved to play with his little cousins at family gatherings. He enjoyed a good conversation, which usually ended in a good laugh. Brandon loved spending time with family and friends at Clear Lake each summer. He was also a great lover of family trips. After he moved to Denver, he continued his career at Empower Financial Services as an internal sales director. Russell Ledi of Avondale, Arizona, age 80, passed away March 1st due to congestive heart failure. A private service for family and close friends will be held at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home Friday, March 24th at 2 p.m. at Cedar Memorial Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. This will be followed by a celebration of life from 3 to 5 p.m. for all family and friends to attend at Kingston Steakhouse and Event Venue, 568 Boyson Road Northeast in Cedar Rapids. He was married to his wife for 63 years. He worked for his father-in-law Raymond Happel at Happel & Sons as a salesman in the 1960s. He then became a successful farm implement dealer at International Harvester and finished his career with Case IH. He loved selling farm equipment and working daily to help farmers. Memories include his white shorts worn daily, love for the Hawkeyes and Green Bay Packers, attending the Iowa State Fair, passion for auto racing, and his devotion to family and friends. Russ loved to golf and go to his favorite watering holes. Russ also played softball and developed lifelong friendships. James Allen Melsha of Kaiser, Oregon, passed away on March 7th, 2023 in Salem, Oregon at the age of 78. He went to Jefferson High School in Cedar Rapids in 1962. In Kaiser, Oregon, he worked for sporting goods store Stouts for a short time. In the early 1980s, he went to work for the state of Oregon and with the Oregon State Police at the State Capitol Building and as a rangemaster. He retired from OSP in 2003 and continued to work for several more years as a retiree. Graveside services will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, March 24th at Czech National Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. A location and time for gathering to follow the burial is to be determined. Scott Allam Bascom. On the evening of March 13, 2023, Scott Allam Bascom passed on at the age of 75. He was a working musician. He earned his way into the Iowa Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Scott's kind nature and endearing sense of humor made people truly love him. Loyal and devoted, he remained madly in love with his wife, Lori, for 40 years. No services are planned at this time. Nancy Winter, age 88, a former resident of Marion, peacefully passed away on March 7th in Bella Vista, Arkansas, with a family by her side. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, March 30th, at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. Interment of cremains will follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Nancy attended nurses' training courses at Co., but she met a nursing candidate and was married. As the children grew and attended school, Nancy returned to medical studies, after which she enjoyed working as a medical assistant and later as a physician's assistant. She once moved to California, where she found work as an underwriter for Sears Savings Bank, and some years later she returned to Cedar Rapids. After a bumpy beginning with a temporary job or two, Nancy found her niche as a medical receptionist. As a woman of leisure, Nancy enjoyed unlimited free time with friends and family. She was a huge fan of sleeping late into the morning, as she often read late into the night. She looked forward to Saturday markets at Taub Park, movies on the big screen, IPTV at home in the evenings, or phone calls with friends who were at a distance. She enjoyed browsing clearance items at Von Maur, always stopping to enjoy their piano music. Nancy would often lunch at Biaggi's, hoping for a spot by their fireplace. She looked forward to Tuesdays and Fridays, when she would join friends inside Marion's Hy-Vee for a hot cup of Starbucks Pike and a warm scone. She was a foodie who enjoyed new items on a menu. She loved getting together with neighbors in her building, enjoyed a small glass of a new wine, and a piece of dark chocolate, or two, or maybe three. Turning to the sports page, NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament. It's time to show up. With the lights shining bright, a trip to Seattle for the Sweet 16 awaits Iowa or Georgia. By Jeff Linder of the Gazette in Iowa City. Always high scoring, always entertaining. If there was a knock on the Iowa women's basketball program in recent years, it was that they could be pushed around, bullied. As the third-ranked Hawkeyes, 27-6, prepare for the NCAA tournament's second-round encounter with Georgia, 22-11, they feel they are more equipped now to match muscle and to push back. "I would say for sure," senior guard Gabby Marshall said. "We face teams that are physical and tough, and we're just going to have to play through it and play through the toughness and be gritty on defense." Or as Kate Martin said, "Bring on the chaos." "Georgia is going to push you around a little bit," Martin said. "Their zone defense is kind of chaotic, not a lot of rhyme or reason to it, but the middle can be open." Tip-off is 2 p.m. in front of a sold-out Carver Hawkeye Arena. The game will be telecast nationally by ABC. Iowa is an 11-point favorite to advance to Seattle next week for the Sweet 16. To do so, they'll have to absorb some body blows. To be succinct, they'll need to be strong, tough. "I think valuing the ball will be very important," Iowa's Caitlin Clark said. "Shot fakes against a team that is more athletic, bigger, longer than us. At the same time, I'm not sure they've seen a team that has as many shooters as we do on the perimeter." So yeah, this is absolutely a contrast of styles. A track meet favors the Hawkeyes, who lead the nation in scoring at 87.5 points per game. A slog plays into the hands of the Bulldogs, who allow 58.4 points per contest. "They can be physical," Iowa coach Lisa Bluter said of the Bulldogs. "They have a lot of fouls to give. The more we can shoot the three, the more they'll have to spread out their zone." Without a doubt, Iowa will have the best player on the floor in Clark. The National Player of the Year frontrunner averages 27 points, 7.5 rebounds, and a nation's best 8.5 assists per game. "Caitlin is a great player and does a lot for her team," Georgia's Diamond Battle said. "She disrupts, she makes you change your game plan and everything." A Cedar Rapids native, Georgia coach Katie Abramson Henderson has her fourth school in the NCAA tournament. She previously took Missouri State, Albany, and Central Florida into March Madness. She is in her first year in Athens and reloaded the program quickly. "I don't think anybody in their right mind would have ever thought our team would have been here signing 10 portal kids," she said. 10, that's a lot. Win or lose, Iowa's Monica Cisnano and McKenna Warnock will play their final games at Carver Hawkeye Arena today. Cisnano ranks third all-time at Iowa in scoring with 2,338 points. Warnock is 30th with 1,220. Right now, it's all business, Warnock said. Cisnano was a little more reflective. It's special to think about, she said. This place has given me so much, so I want to protect it. This will be Iowa's third consecutive sellout. The Hawkeyes aren't the only ones eager for the noise. Every athlete lives for this moment, whether they are cheering for you or cheering against you, Battles said. You get to play in front of a sold-out arena. Who wouldn't want to do that? The lights are on, and it's time to show up. And in Iowa State news, NCAA Women's Tournament, Ashley Jones' era ends with Cyclones loss. By Rob Gray, correspondent. The Ashley Jones era at Iowa State has ended. The Cyclones' all-time leading scorer and rebounder took the floor for what proved to be the last time in an ISU uniform Saturday, as her fifth-seeded team fell 80-73 to 12th-seeded Toledo at Thompson Bowling Arena in Knoxville, Tennessee. I wouldn't change it for the world, Jones told reporters after the game. I love Iowa State, my teammate, and my coaches. I've been blessed to play here. Jones scored 23 points and grabbed 13 rebounds to close her storied Cyclone career with her 65th double-double. Jones, like most of her ISU teammates, struggled to hit shots, finishing 5 of 19 from the field. The Cyclones, 22-10, shot 34.9% overall and 19.4% from three-point range, while the Rockets, 29-4, shot 48.4% from the field and 38.6% from long range. The game didn't go well, but that doesn't take away from what they did on a daily basis, ISU head coach Bill Fennelly said of his team. ISU never led in the final three quarters, but pulled within 5 at 78-73 on Danae Fritz's three-pointer with 29 seconds left. Toledo sealed the win with a pair of Sophia Weird free throws, despite being held without a field goal for the final 3:40. Jones finished her ISU career atop the record book in 11 statistical categories. She ranks 9th all-time in NCAA Division I women's history in scoring with 3,060 points and helped the Cyclones post a record 25 wins last season. Jones also played a key role in ISU's first Big 12 tournament title since 2001 and now looks forward to what should be a promising professional career. Lexi Donarski added 12 points for ISU. Emily Ryan and Fritz scored 11 points apiece. Jones had a team-best 2 steals and matched the team high with 3 assets to round out her strong final effort as a Cyclone. Not the way we wanted the season to end, but looking back, it was a great 5 years, Jones said. From the Insight page, Kurt Ulrich's guest column. Kurt Ulrich lives in rural Jackson County, and his book, The Iowa State Fair, is available from Iowa University Press. Kurt writes, memories of people and pets remain in our hearts. Many people seem to know Ruby, but I met her for the first time just last week. While waiting in a shop to chat with a guy about my lawnmower, I was crouched down, looking at a riding mower that was for sale, and I could sense a nearby presence. A foot away, to my left, a set of sad brown eyes quietly pondered my existence, something I do regularly. It was an old shaggy dog named Ruby, come over to check on the old guy visiting a business owned by her keeper, a small engine shop, to which I take my lawnmowers when they need maintenance. High schools once offered a class in small engine repair, and it may still be an elective, I don't know. However, I do know this. To my great shame, I used to see those classes as somehow beneath me, as courses for those who had spent a lifetime with grease under their fingernails, and that wasn't going to be me. 50 years ago, I helped my father remove an auto engine and replace it with another, and my involvement surprised my mother. Much as she loved and encouraged me, she also had a way of reminding me that I was nothing special. I didn't think you ever got your hands dirty. It was a warning shot, and I've tried to hold it close ever since. I own my arrogance. I was dead wrong. The person who can dismantle a machine, diagnose a problem, reassemble the parts, and return it to useful life has their own kind of genius, one which I envy. We pay athletes millions of dollars to entertain us, while those who keep the machinery of the world in good running order go begging. Makes no sense to me. I could go on, but I'll shut up now. Anyway, Ruby was simply curious about the stranger who wandered into her shop, and once she realized I was harmless, and possibly good for a dog biscuit, she stood next to me when I rose up, leaning gently against my leg. This was totally unexpected. Affection, trust, and devotion from a newly met old dog. Then her keeper said what I already guessed. I don't expect she'll make it through the summer. Perhaps I make entirely too much of brief encounters with people and animals, as I have neither wise nor clever offerings about the meanings of such things. People and pets come and go, and we keep them tucked away in our hearts, coaxing them out every once in a while when we need them the most. Recently, I attended a big band concert performed by the still incredible Count Basie Orchestra. When I was a young man, I met and photographed Count Basie, so when I saw that his orchestra was showing up 40 miles away, I had to be there. A friend joined me, and next to her was an empty seat. When the performance was over, she said, "That was a beautiful concert. My father sat down next to me." All very matter-of-fact, not the ghost of my father was here, not it felt like my father was with me, not my father would have loved this. He was there with her, and I was sentient enough not to say a word. I have no doubt that her father savored every bit of the concert and especially enjoyed being at the side of his beautiful daughter. And I also have no doubt that when another summer has come and gone, every once in a while I will feel an old dog named Ruby leaning softly against my leg. And in the time machine, a look back at the people, places, and events in eastern Iowa, Iowa's first Carnegie Library, 130-year-old building, now is a museum in Fairfield, by Diane Fannin Langton, correspondent. When a Jefferson County library opened in 1853, it was housed in rented rooms and open only to those who could pay dues. It had accumulated 20,000 books by January 1892, when the library received a letter from Washington, D.C., from Iowa's U.S. Senator James F. Wilson, who lived in Jefferson County. He wrote that Pittsburgh steel magnate Andrew Carnegie had agreed to donate $40,000, more than $1.3 million in today's dollars, to build a public library in Fairfield. The Jefferson County Library Museum was built at 112 South Court Street on land donated by Wilson. The building was designed by architect C. Stafford of Kansas City, Missouri. It was the first Carnegie Library built outside Pennsylvania, and the first of 101 Carnegie Libraries that eventually would be built in Iowa. It also was the only Carnegie Library built without any stipulations attached. The library, dedicated November 28, 1893, still stands, and now is the Jefferson County Carnegie Library Museum. The library was a large building constructed almost entirely of stone and iron in a substantial manner, comprising not only all requisites for a library, but a hall seated with opera chairs and a museum filled with specimens of natural history, geology, etc., the Muscatine Journal reported February 26, 1894. The library's third-floor museum housed Dr. J. M. Schaefer's natural history collection of 684 mounted bird and animal specimens, acquisitions of Native American curios from W. W. Junkin, a collection of Roman antiquities and relics from Italy and Switzerland from Major S. J. Byers, and archaeological items purchased from Samuel B. Evans. But any building requires maintenance, and those expenses became a concern. W. H. Johnson of the Iowa State Library Association asked if the solution might lie with the city of Fairfield. What if the city took over those expenses? The stockholders of the Jefferson County Library Association supported that idea. The matter was put to a vote, in which women were allowed to cast a ballot in 1899. The measure passed by a wide margin, with citizens agreeing to a small tax to support the library. In 1914, the museum acquired its iconic buffalo head. In the early 1900s, Maple Grove Farms owner J.O. Singmaster of Keota had a herd of buffalo. Two buffalo were slaughtered for the 1912 Fairfield Old Settlers Celebration and again in 1913, with the hides and heads sold. E.R. Smith presented one of the mounted heads to the library at the 1914 Old Settlers Celebration. "May it be preserved for hundreds of years as a memento of pioneer days," he said during the presentation. It was recently refurbished and still hangs in the museum stairwell. At Fairfield Centennial in 1939, the Fairfield Daily Ledger reported how the library would help the city celebrate. "The museum will be open each day during the centennial," the Ledger reported. "The basement room has been rearranged with the department publications in convenient arrangement." Also, the old newspapers in the library's basement proved a valuable resource for centennial information. In June 1940, when it was determined the weight of the library's timber and slate roof was damaging the building, the gabled roof was removed and replaced by a flat roof, with a firewall added to the top. Damaged brick walls and the chimney also were repaired. Senator Wilson's granddaughter visited the library in 1956 looking for her grandmother's scrapbooks. She also found her grandfather's personal papers, including letters from Carnegie and President Ulysses S. Grant, in the drawers of an old bookcase. The Jefferson County Carnegie Library Museum is celebrating the building's 130th year. The building was listed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1983. The public library moved to a new building in 1996, and the museum now shares the original library building with Indian Hills Community College classes held on the second floor. The other two floors have Jefferson County historical artifacts, including a spinning wheel once owned by Mary Ann Rutledge, mother of Anne Rutledge, reportedly Abraham Lincoln's first love. And that brings me to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, March 19th, 2023, on the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service. The articles have been selected and lightly edited by me, Sharon Falduto, your reader, reading to you from my kitchen table in Coralville, as usual. Remember that we welcome comments, and you can access recordings of this or any other Iris recordings at any time on our website, iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening.